Welcome. Thank you for being here. Justice Stiglitz is unable to be with us today. I was hopeful that she might be able to join and listen simultaneously, but she'll likely listen afterwards and then deliberate with us later, okay? Are both sides ready to proceed? Yes? Do you wish to retain any time for rebuttal?
Yes, sir. Hopefully 5 minutes.
Okay. All right. And Mr. Meyer, you can get started as soon as you're ready.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices of the Nevada Supreme Court. May it please the Court. My name is Michael Caleb Meyer, and I represent the petitioners in this matter. The issue presented here today is not just one of first impression in the state of Nevada. It's not just one that affects only the litigants and psychologists in this case. Rather, the issue before this court is one with industry-wide ramifications that threatens the integrity and validity of mental health testing that all psychologists rely upon when evaluating and treating mental health conditions, not just in litigated matters, but in the context of employment, education, even eligibility for state and federal benefits. In that regard, the district court's error in this case, threatens public health. And while the effects of this error may be far-reaching, the legal issue presented to this court is really very simple. Whether in a judicial proceeding, a court is permitted to order the disclosure of psychological test data and materials to a non-psychologist in direct contravention of NAC 641.234. The answer to that question is very simply no. And the reason why is that ordering compliance with NAC 641.234 is entirely harmonious with Nevada's discovery rules and statutes. By erroneously concluding that NRCP 16.1 constituted a specific state law requiring disclosure of neuropsychological data and material, and thus constituting an exception to NAC 641.234, the district court erroneously ordered Dr. Consora to disclose neuropsychological test data and materials to non-psychologists in direct contravention of a duly enacted regulation. In doing so, this court misapplied Nevada law and abused its discretion in entitling the petitioner to relief.
Mr. Meyer, why isn't a protective order enough here?
So, two different reasons. First and foremost, the protective order exists only until potentially only until a specific point in time, and that time is trial. Once a trial is to occur, and there's the presumption in Nevada that courts are open to the public. Once that happens, the disclosure of this highly protected and sensitive data has to be disclosed outside of the parties, and it has to be disclosed namely to jurors or anybody else who is potentially observing a public trial. And so the protections that would be afforded during litigation subject to the protective order now all of a sudden then go away in the form of a public trial. Now, Nevada courts can fashion a remedy to close trials, but the standard, there's a presumption that trials should remain open to the public, particularly in a civil setting. And in doing so, what a protective order requires it requires that trial courts now weigh on every given case. Anytime there is neuropsychological data that may be at issue, courts now have to apply whether or not there's a compelling interest to close a trial and to close a courtroom for purposes of now talking about this highly protective information. The other reason why a protective order are not sufficient in protecting the balance the integrity of this material is that it requires that be entered in every single case.
But I mean that's how every, say, trademark cases, right? So if there's some litigation over the formula for Diet Coke, right, that might have to be disclosed and subject to protective orders. The courts do that every day.
They do. But I would also submit that whether or not a protective order is a way to fashion protection over this type of material, it isn't really relevant to the analysis of the statute of the regulation and the need for a law to be enforced, and this enforceable regulation that requires enforcement.
Let me back you up, if I might. What part of NRS 641-100 are you relying on for the belief that the board was authorized to create this type of a regulation?
Sure. So we believe that the statute requires or allows or gives authority to the board to regulate the practice of psychology. This involves, and general matter, and that involves not just individuals or experts who are retained for litigation. This applies to all psychologists in any way, shape, or form. And so that broad authority is given to the board and delegated to the board to enact this very type of a regulation. Now,
does it give the board the ability to regulate judicial proceedings?
Well, what I would submit to the court is that that's not what the board has done here. The court hasn't regulated judicial proceedings because the enforcement of this regulation can be enforced consistent and in harmony with all of the disclosure rules that exist, whether it be 16.1, whether it be 50.305, which is an evidentiary rule, whether it be Rule 35 that governs independent medical examinations or mental or physical examinations. This statute doesn't actually conflict with any of those. So the board isn't necessarily, the board isn't governing the disclosure of this information because this isn't a disclosure issue. This information under the rule is subject to disclosure. It just is subject to disclosure to licensed professionals who are the ones that are duly qualified to be able to analyze it and to be able
how
to do that.
What's going to happen then? So as I understand it in the proceedings below, you didn't object to disclosing it to the plaintiff's expert, a qualified neuropsychologist, as I understand it, but did object to providing it to the plaintiff's counsel. Right?
That's correct.
Okay. So what's going to happen? It gets disclosed to the plaintiff's expert. What's that person supposed to do with it when they have concerns or have ideas for cross-examination questions? Or what? Can they not talk to the plaintiff's counsel and say, hey, you need to follow up on this?
They can talk about the results and their interpretation of the results as it relates to the test questions and the test material. What they cannot do is disclose the actual test question. So the neuropsychological raw data is utilized for purposes, there's an element of interpretation that only psychologists are trained to be able to address. Attorneys aren't equipped, non-psychologists, those who are not qualified, they're not equipped to be able to interpret those results. So even though there may be those types of differences that exist between the psychologist and the psychologist on either side, okay, they certainly can assist attorneys in the preparation of cross-examination.
How do you get to the point? You've got an expert on the other side that comes to the attorney and says these questions are slanted, they're biased. How do you ever test that then?
I believe that the test questions themselves are standardized, meaning all the neuropsychologists have access to the same tests. They have the same test questions. So in this case, Dr. Elliott has access to the test questions that Dr. Consora did. And so
if they throw in a few biased questions or slanted questions, Well, I don't think discover that. How do you test that?
I don't think that there's any. There's no evidence in the record that any of that occurred in this case. However, to the extent that that hypothetical is to occur in the future, nothing prohibits, I don't believe, the neuropsychologist from commenting on that as it relates to the results of testing. Whether that results in the effect of the test results that are given, because the test results are disclosed.
Right.
Well, and it's just the test questions and the raw data that needs to be interpreted that there is a protection.
What does the test results mean? Like, what is... Like, okay, you... I don't know what form that would take. Can you explain to me what that looks like to have test results but not know the test questions or the test answers?
So the raw data that are the answers given to the test questions, they are interpreted in a way that I don't know how the test questions themselves, because I've never seen them, I've never been able to evaluate them or analyze them, but the results are interpreted in a way that the results can be interpreted in a way that
so the results would be just, you know, is normal or abnormal or this slow in this area, adept in this area, and that's it.
They fall within a range, that's correct, that gives conclusions about a level of function.
So if you attack that or potentially criticize it, find fault with it, unless you can see what the questions were and how the person being examined answered them to know, like, is this person making it up or is it a valid evaluation?
Because, well, the answer to the question is the psychologist who has access to that, a competing psychologist who has access to that, has the ability to interpret that data and to be able to come to their own expert conclusions and opinions. And there may be a disagreement with a competing expert as to what...
Do they have to communicate with the attorney who's the actual presenter in court?
They can. I believe that they can communicate with the attorney and inform the attorney effectively to establish effective cross-examination without having to reveal what the test questions themselves are. And in this case, so
how would that make sense to a jury? Like, the jury has to make a decision, and one neuropsychologist says this analysis is right, and the other one says this one is wrong, and the jury has, like, how are they supposed to figure that out with no information about what the underlying data is?
Well, like in most cases, the jury makes determinations about the credibility of witnesses and the conclusions they come to based upon a whole host of different information. The inherent problem that is fundamental to this case is whether these problems or challenges exist or not. The regulation 641.234 specifically precludes and specifically legally precludes the disclosure of this information other than to a duly qualified psychologist. And Rule 16.1, now there's 16.1 doesn't require that every single bit of information, data, or facts upon which an expert relied for their opinion must be attached or disclosed. Federal law.
What's the harm here that makes this so much more special than any other bit of discovery that we deal with in litigation every day?
I would encourage the court to look very closely at Dr. Kinzor's amicus brief in this case, because I think he does an extensive job of explaining the danger of the disclosure of this information and it relates to public health.
I honestly didn't understand that. How do you cheat on a neuropsychological exam?
So these neuropsychological tests are designed, there's certain aspects of the testing that are specifically designed to detect whether people are telling the truth, whether they're malingering, whether they're giving a full effort. And the second that...
Right, but it's things that test, like, your processing speed, your memory. So, you know, they give you a list of five words, and 5 minutes later they ask you, what were those five words? Like, I'm just, or draw, there's a, they give you a picture and you draw the picture, you draw a clock and you draw a time on the clock. I'm trying to understand how you could coach somebody to either do better or worse on this test, because it doesn't seem like that's really possible.
Well, there's a reason so there is a standard within the psychological industry that an individual cannot, or a psychologist cannot, apply neuropsychological testing within 6 months of a previous test. And the reason for that is because of recency bias. So there is a danger that an individual who has answered questions or these questions similarly within a certain period of time will invalidate essentially the new test. Now,
right, because they would do better the next time.
But that
would be helpful to the defense, right? If somebody did better on a neuropsychological exam.
Well, it may or may not, but I would suggest that, you know, defendants aren't trying to do tests necessarily to do things that are better. They're trying to get a better result. They're trying to do tests to truly evaluate a person's condition in the context of litigation. Now, like I said, this goes well beyond, you know, goes well outside of the field of litigation, of course. But the very danger of the ability to coach the test or to teach the test, if this is disclosed, once this is out there, and an attorney...
Well, isn't a lot of it out there already, though? Like, you can find an MMPI on the internet.
Yes, but not all tests are subject to disclosure. They're not out all in the public realm. And what I would say is that...
So how much of it is not out there?
I would have to do a search on the internet to find out. What I would say is that the State Board of Psychologists has seen it important enough under the authority that it's been delegated by this legislature, has seen this as an important enough issue to enact this regulation to protect this type of information. And it's an important enough public policy issue that's what they did. And the effect of not of allowing courts to disclose this information will ultimately have a chilling effect where ultimately no psychologists may be willing to be involved in litigation, subject to their own discipline by the board. Thank you.
I'm going to give you 2 minutes of rebuttal time in light of all of our questions, okay? And we'll add 2 minutes to counsel's time.
Thank you.
Response as well. Thank you. And Mr. Creed, you can begin whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Jesse Creed. I represent the respondent, Real Party in Interest, Vaskin Ohanian. Good afternoon. May it please the court. I think the briefs lay out the interpretation of the two provisions at issue. And while defendants seem to make this case feel like an ordinary case of regulatory or statutory interpretation, I would like to emphasize the unprecedented nature of defendants' claims. First, a procedural point. Defendant is asking for a writ, which is extraordinary relief, on their third motion for reconsideration of an evidentiary ruling. It's not a discovery order, but an order on a motion in limine. The district court found that the administrative regulation was in effect prior to defendant's first two motions for reconsideration, and defendant did not raise the issue and said it was not new law. That's paragraph 6 of the court's order. Thus, defendants have significant hurdles to obtain this writ. They waive the claim, and it's an evidentiary ruling. In their own cases, the Club Vista versus the 8th Judicial Circuit case shows that there's no writ relief cited. There's no writ case they've cited on an evidentiary ruling. The relief requested by defendants, the second point I'd like to make, the relief requested by defendants makes clear that they are, in essence, claiming a privilege over this information, that they have a right to refuse to disclose this information. They have a right to refuse to answer questions on cross-examination. They even have a right to claw back information they've already provided. That's all in their writ petition as the relief they seek. They want to require defendant plaintiffs to destroy the raw data that he did provide, although he has not complied with the complete order as the district court has found. Nevada statutes are clear, and they have not presented any case law to the contrary, that no one has the right to refuse to disclose information in a civil proceeding unless a statute permits that refusal. And that statute has to create the right. That's NRS section 49.015. Defendants don't even address that statutory language in their reply brief. Finally, defendants claim an administrative regulation enacted by an occupational licensing board not only bars disclosure of expert materials to plaintiff and his counsel, but also bars cross-examination of the expert on those materials. I understand there were some questions about that. I want to point out how far their position goes. If the expert scored the test wrong, we are barred from cross-examining that expert on such a simple, even mathematical error like that. That's how far the defendant's position goes. In this case, there were some questions from the justices about biased questions or slanted questions. That actually is in the record. There is evidence in the record, and that is an issue in the case. The Consora's main point about Dr. Elliott's tests that he used is that Consora's tests are more appropriate for someone like the plaintiff who's multicultural and speaks five languages. That's on page 3 and page 8 of our brief. We go through Consora's opinions on that. Well, what if you look at the questions, some of the questions, you may be able to challenge that supposition. For example, the question could be to someone who is not high school educated, has not been raised in the United States, speaks five languages, what is the capital of Vermont? Well, is someone from Las Vegas expected to know that who has not grown up and had an elementary school education in the United States? Maybe, and that those are questions. Capitals of countries or states are questions on these types of tests. Fourth, defendants claim...
Counsel, if the concern, though, is protecting the validity of these tests, how do we balance that out? I mean, what is the harm in having the data go to a similar sort of expert?
Well, the harm is, the harm would be that the plaintiff's counsel would not have the data to enable the plaintiff's counsel to conduct a cross-examination. So if the regulation is enforced, then what they want is for their data to go to our neuropsychologist and then create a conflict with our neuropsychologist from being able to disclose it to us. That's what the defense neuropsychologist typically set up in these cases. So the harm becomes that we do not have the actual data when we believe the rules require that disclosure under 16.1.
How do you respond to their argument that no psychologists will choose to be involved in litigation because this creates an ethical problem for them?
Yes, Your Honor. So I'm barred in 4 states, Nevada, Hawaii, California. California has Randy's Trucking. Randy's Trucking is a case that's been on the books for a while. Neuropsychologists happen day in and day out in those personal injury cases. And that I would also point out, Randy's Trucking's been on the books for a while, and the sky hasn't fallen. These neuropsychologists continue to rely on these examinations and the data. There's no claim that the validity has been disputed. I know there was the question about, well, you know, what's the empirical claim that there will be harm? First of all, that is an empirical claim. And I don't think that there's anything in the record to necessarily support it. And frankly, it should be the district court that can make, as Randy Strucking said, you can make an argument to the district court on the empirical claim, and the district court can decide whether the empirical claim of whether there's sufficient harm outweighs the probative value to the plaintiff. And that would be a good cause analysis under a protective order. But in this case, that was presented to the district court, and district court said 16.1 controls, in my view, and defendants have a right to this data for cross-examination. Plaintiffs. So I think the empirical claim is not borne out because we do have, as someone had mentioned, you can buy these things on eBay. They've been disclosed, subject to protective orders. And really, the empirical claim rests on a premise which I don't think any court should adopt, which is that lawyers are going to violate the protective orders, that lawyers are going to use the test questions that they obtained in one case to coach one of their clients in another case, assuming that the client's even coachable on these things. But that is the premise of the empirical claim by Dr. Consora in his brief, by the Boone article which they submitted, another defense neuropsychologist. And that empirical claim rests on a premise which I don't think any court should adopt. And it was discussed in the questioning of Mr. Meyer. Well, Coca-Cola may be forced to disclose their trade secret, which has a lot more economic value than these neuropsychological tests. And imagine if Coca-Cola could say, well, we don't trust the lawyers on the other side from actually keeping it secret from their clients. That's just not how litigation works. We have to presume that protective orders will be followed, and that when it's disclosed to the plaintiff or the plaintiff's counsel, that they will use it only for this litigation, just like Judge Beresich had ruled at the hearing.
Is there any analog to this issue not in the neuropsychological test result area? And what I'm thinking about is broadly, you have expert testimony, you want to put an expert on. The expert, you're careful with what you give the expert, because if you give it to the expert, I mean, just sort of basic stuff, it's subject to disclosure at that point, if it's appropriate. And I'm just trying to think of anything that's analogous to this neuropsychological debate, which has been going on for a little while, whether there's any other area that you know of that sort of plows this same ground.
I am not aware of an area, another area. I think that there is a protectionist streak in the neuropsychological field. I think that's ultimately what this comes down to, that they're trying to retain value in these tests. I don't believe the validity concern is real because of the general accessibility of these tests already.
I mean, I'm not disparaging the value of it, to be clear. What I'm getting at is if you want to rely on something and present expert testimony on it, the norm is that I'm familiar with that if you want to put that out there, then you're going to need to submit to examination on the underlying premises and data that you're relying on. There's no prerogative to talk about something then say, well, I don't want to talk about that piece of it.
Absolutely not. There's no other parallel. I mean, that is what makes this unprecedented and what makes it a privilege. The only time you get to not talk about something in court is when you have a privilege.
Well, but if you give it to the expert, you're waiving your privilege. I mean, yes, you are.
If you're giving the expert something of your work product, for example, you would waive that privilege.
I mean, like, you don't do that.
Yes. But I'm not aware of another occupation that has been so protective of their facts or data than the neuropsychological occupation, other than attorneys, of course. But that's a different issue entirely.
Okay. Counsel, can you reconcile the NAC, the 641, with 16.1? Are they in conflict? Can they be read in harmony?
Our briefs make clear they can be read in harmony. So, and I want to touch on that. Our approach is a duty-based approach. If there's a specific duty to disclose, then that would be within the exception in the administrative regulation. And 16.1 offers that specific duty to disclose.
But does the exception swallow the rule?
No, because there could be examples where they do, for example, I know there's a dispute about whether NRCP Rule 35 requires these kinds of disclosures, But I can imagine, for example, a court saying, well, NRCP 35 doesn't require it. 16.1 does, but they don't designate the person as a testifying expert, so they wouldn't be subject to 16.1. It's only when they have decided to call that expert to trial that 16.1's mandate comes into effect. And they're at two stages. I know there's a dispute about whether the examiner's only subject to 35 or 35 and 16.1 as plaintiffs propose. It's the first time I'd ever heard this dispute. Any Rule 35 examiner that any party chooses to call to trial is then subject to 16.1. It's just a different provision. So I think they're fully in harmony with the duty-based approach. I also think that the specific subject matter approach they're taking, like you have to specifically use magic words like neuropsychologist or psychological test data, that it has to be that specific. I don't think there's any statutory interpretation precedent for that. If there is a specific duty requiring you to disclose, then it's required by specific state law. That's the plaintiff's approach.
What is your position on the question I asked Mr. Meyer about in terms of the authority of the board to promulgate a regulation like this? And their position seems to be, well, the board has the authority to regulate the practice of psychology. So would that allow them to regulate how their work product, for lack of a better word, could be utilized subsequent in a judicial proceeding?
So our position is the board lacks this authority. We cited the NRS statute that gave is the organic statute of the board that provides the board with its rulemaking power. It does allow for it's an occupational licensing board. It allows for just like the state bar, you can set the standards and qualifications for people to obtain a license. You can enforce those standards to protect the public, but it certainly does not stretch to regulating civil discovery and judicial proceedings. And it would create a slippery slope if, in my view, it also opened the floodgates to any other of the occupational licensing boards. And believe it or not, I counted the number in Nevada before I got here. There's 37 occupational licensing boards in the state of Nevada. And adopting the position of the defendant in this case would essentially authorize all 37 of those occupational licensing boards to come up with their own views on what is in the public interest or not with respect to civil discovery and judicial proceedings. So I certainly think that, you know, accountants, pharmacists, engineers, doctors, nurses, landscape architects, you know, their job is to protect the public and by making sure that their professionals are qualified. And this goes far beyond that and seeks to regulate civil discovery and even the exercise of discretion by a district court with respect to what's a fair proceeding for the parties.
What's your position? So if you're right and your position, I guess, remains because you prevailed so far in the district court on this particular issue. So plaintiff's expert would receive this data and plaintiff's counsel would receive this data, all subject to protective order. Would plaintiff themselves be able to receive those documents and who else?
Well, So I think the order as it's written allows for disclosure to plaintiff's counsel. At trial, you know, I think that I would argue revisited to the extent that there are questions about how the questions were phrased to this plaintiff, because you would want to ask him how, you know, you saw this question. Well, did you ever have any education about what the capital of Vermont was? Did you ever have any education about, you know, even the capital of Nevada for my plaintiff? You know, he doesn't even have a high school education, and he was a bagman at McCarran Airport. So a lot of people think it's Las Vegas or Reno, but it's not. So that would be an example. And we might want to actually present that kind of question to him. But I do think that this district judge, having been at the hearing, argued with her, in front of her.
Yes.
this district judge was very careful, you know, and if you look at the transcript, for example, there was a question about, well, Mr. Meyer brought up about bringing this up at trial. Well, the transcript was clear that she said, if this is coming in at any point, I'm going to seal the pleading if it's filed, and I would make sure that we seal the courtroom if the defendant has met the burden on sealing the courtroom. Now, obviously, no judge likes to seal the courtroom. It's burdensome. But, I do think I think it should be up to the discretion of the judge on that issue, and that's something to be decided at a later point.
This is a change in topics, but as I read your brief, you're saying that you think 16.1, the report requirements in that, specifically the facts or data considered by the witness in performing that, you think that that is in addition to 35B2, which is the contents of the specific report that is required of an IME examiner, you think that they both apply?
They would both apply. They both apply to any examining expert, yes.
And anyone who does. So why wouldn't 35B be the more specific and then control in this setting by itself?
Because 16.1 also applies as soon as defendant decides to call the Rule 35 examining physician as an expert at trial.
And but it's at the point they're called, so the report must comply with 35, but you're saying when they're called as a witness, but that's a Rule 50, that's a NRS 50 issue. 16.1 is a disclosure report issue. So to me, I would have thought that 16.1 would be a general report and 35 would be IME specific.
So 35 is a report. Our position is that Rule 35 requires a report for any examining any medical examiner, whether it's a physician
or
a
psychologist. And it says what the report needs to contain.
Correct.
It's brief. But.
And then if you decide, and this is uniformly interpreted in the federal courts for Rule 35 and Rule 26,
okay.
I know my time is up. But if you decide to call that expert at trial, then you also have to comply with the expert witness disclosures.
I agree with that. Under their federal rule of evidence, whatever the number is, 705. But 16.1B, disclosure of expert testimony, is talking about a report, not when you call them.
16.1B, so if you do you can have a situation, this happens frequently, in someone who's, for example, very injured and everyone agrees. The defendant will still do a Rule 35 exam, maybe for their insurer otherwise. They'll get an independent doctor to opine and then decide, you know what, this isn't good for us. I'm not going to call this person at trial. They then do not have to complete a Rule 16.1.
But neither would they need the 16.1B report either.
They would if they decide to call that person at trial.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Two remaining points I want to just follow up on very briefly. The respondent continues to assert that that the regulation is invalid. And what I would note is that the APA specifically, there's a process that is required to invalidate a duly enacted regulation in this regard. And that's NRS 233B.110. And it requires the board to be made a party. It requires the board to have a say and be able to defend the regulation. It requires a declaratory judgment action to be filed in district court. So as much as the respondent may not like the regulation as we sit here today is duly enacted and regulated, whether or not
But that doesn't abrogate our ability to rule it unconstitutional, for instance, if we find such, we're not bound by those regulations and those procedures.
No, I would just I cite that for the proposition that if the court is inclined to invalidate it, then the proper party from who enacted it and the purposes for it and should be able to defend the statute. From our from the petitioner's perspective, the statute or the regulation exists. It was duly enacted, and it specifically and it has the force of law in Nevada, just like a statute does. It has the same effect of law that any other statute that's enacted directly by the legislature may have. And in that regard, the scope of the issue for this court is really very narrow for this case. And is this exists? Can we harmonize it with 16.1? And just you hit the nail on the head. The problem with the analysis, and this may have finished my, just finish this point, I apologize. You hit the nail on the head. The problem with the district court's analysis was that it allows the exception to swallow the rule. The rule is null and void if the exception requires the disclosure of neuropsychological data. Then the rule has no purpose. Thank you.
So, sorry, Chief, can I ask? So the purpose of the regulation was to overcome what is otherwise required by Rule 16.1. Is that your position?
No, I don't believe that Rule 16.1 requires an expert to produce every minutia upon which the expert, every bit of minutia upon which the expert bases their opinion. And when I say that, here's what I mean. The Rule 16.1 essentially requires a description of the facts and data upon which the expert relied in forming their opinions. And that issue as to whether the facts and data under 16.1 requires things like neuropsychological reports, that's never been addressed in Nevada. But federal courts that have construed Rule 26A2 in the federal rules, the counterpart to six, which is almost equivalent to Rule 16.1, they have held that we can't. That language of 16.1 is similar to 26A2. Actually, required. It's a notice type of standard where you have to describe the data and information that you relied upon in forming your opinions. That's exactly what happened in this case. Dr. Kinsora described all of the tests he did. He described all of the results of the tests. He described all of the literature upon which he relied. And the absurdity of requiring the attachment of every single piece of information upon which an expert may rely. Think about it in this regard. If a medical expert is doing an IME, a physical examination, it is impossible for that expert to attach every medical treatise he's ever read, every handout he was ever given in medical school. The purpose of the rule is to give notice as to a description of the things that the expert reviewed or relied upon, the data or facts upon which the expert relied in forming their opinions. And that's how federal courts have interpreted the similar language in terms, rather than actually having to provide necessarily this type of information. And I concede that in the this arena, okay, the neuropsychological testing data is a bit unique in and of itself. And the reason for that is because of the uniqueness of the testing and as it relates to how it relates to psychological functioning, mental functioning. It is unique. It's fundamentally different than physical exam testing, for which there is no proprietary value over, the compression tests or those types of things. So it is conceded. It is a unique.
Okay, I think you answered my question. Thank you.
With the permission of the Chief, I have one question, which is the same one I asked him. Is there any other area that you can identify for me where a similar prerogative has been extended or asserted?
I can't think of one as I sit here today, and I think that points to the uniqueness of this particular bit of information and why this doesn't have the danger of expanding to other things. This is a very unique bit of information, and that's why it was enacted by the board.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, gentlemen.